UK writer Toby Young, next on The Culture Catch.
I don't care for China, Japan's far too small. I've rumbled the Rio Grande. I hate Asia Minor, I can't bear Bengal. And I shudder to think of the awful stink on the road to Samarkand. It's frankly hell, that filthy smell on the road to Samarkand. But I like America, I have played around every slappy, happy hunting ground, and I find America okay.
Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Final Draft. For the finest scriptwriting software on the planet, visit finaldraft.com. Joining me today on The Culture Catch, the writer and all-around scoundrel, Justin from the UK, old friend from the 90s, back in the Vanity Fair days, Mr. Toby Young. Toby, welcome to The Culture Catch.
Thank you.
You've got a new book, The Sound of No Hands Clapping. A memoir by Toby Young. Why not an ongoing memoir? I mean, you're still a young man.
Actually, it's volume two. I realize I made a fatal mistake in volume one in taking it up to the age of about 37. I realize now I could have got about four memoirs out of that time period, and this really should be number five. I've used up the first 42 years of my life, and I've only got two memoirs out of it. So I don't know how I'm going to pay the bills in the years to come.
You better get some more lawsuits happening. You said that you've had a few.
Yeah.
Or a few threatens.
Well, when there was a character in the last book called I think I'm legally prohibited from telling you which character it was, but there was someone in the last book, and I promised him.
Isn't it extraordinary that people are this concerned about the truth in advertising?
It is extraordinary. I mean, I thought in particular with respect to this guy that he came out of the book really, really well.
Right.
God, I've now identified his gender. There you go. I've narrowed it down considerably. I may be sued. But nevertheless, he hired this, you know, very powerful firm of Hollywood attorneys who had successfully sued a British tabloid, the News of the World, on behalf of Tom and Nicole Kidman. At the time that Eyes Wide Shut was being shot in the UK, the News of the World claimed, falsely, that Tom and Nicole had to hire someone to teach them how to simulate sex on the set of Eyes Wide Shut. Now, this spurious and patently false claim was duly punished by this very powerful Hollywood attorney, and the guy who was upset with what I'd written about him in my book, before the book had even come out. I mean, I sent it to him, and I said, if there's anything you don't like, we can discuss it. And instead of doing that, he just hired this attorney and threatened my UK publishers with all kinds of mischief unless I made him completely unidentifiable, which I then struggled to do.
Oh my God, it's just, this is crazy. I mean, I guess if we were all just hunters and gatherers, there'd be no concern because we wouldn't have all this free time to fret over this.
Well, yeah, it's often the retirees who are the most legally mischievous, who are most prone to kind of nuisance suits. I wrote a story for The Spectator, a British weekly, in the late 90s about Harold Evans's departure from Random House, in which I had the temerity to suggest it wasn't entirely voluntary, which was very much the way he had spun it in the UK. And I didn't repeat any stories. I mean, it was essentially a clippings job, and I didn't repeat anything which hadn't already appeared in the American press somewhere. And he hadn't objected to it when it appeared in the American press, but because Britain's libel laws are much more draconian, he was able to threaten me with a libel suit unless The Spectator printed a retraction. I apologized. We paid a certain sum of money into a charity and so on and so forth. And at the time, Harold Evans was the editorial director of the New York Daily News and U.S. News and World Report. And you kind of think, well, you know, either you believe in the First Amendment, in which case you shouldn't really be coming after me, or you don't, in which case you shouldn't really be doing that job. As a condition of dropping the suit against me, he wanted me to give a written undertaking that I would never write about him or his wife, Tina Brown, ever again. I mean, it was a straightforward attempt to gag this kind of pesky gadfly.
We are in very dangerous and perilous times, Mr. Young. I mean, I think the First Amendment, well, we could get into a whole discourse on politics and how George Bush has manipulated our media here to spin whatever truths he'd like the American public to hear. But did you see his guffaw on the news with the blind reporter?
No.
When it was a cloudy day, and the clip is he stands up, the journalist stands up to ask his question. He goes, "It's pretty bright out here, huh? You need sunglasses." Like, ha, ha, ha. Not realizing the journalist was blind.
Are you a dog lover, sir? Yeah.
And the journalist had the good sense of humor. He wasn't offended by that. He was offended that he never got to ask the question.
Right. I managed to sidestep a similar landmine yesterday. I gave a reading at a bookstore downtown, and to my left were three deaf people, and whilst I was trying to read, they were having a really animated conversation, but in sign language. So they weren't actually saying anything. But
it was a distraction.
From the point of view of anyone actually looking at me, and there I was doing my best to kind of really give it some oomph and really perform the different parts, do the voices. Nobody was looking at me. They were all looking at this kind of really, what looked like a really heated argument between these three. Maybe they were in a love triangle or something. There's one pretty girl and two guys. But, you know, really kind of gesticulating like they were on crack or something. And I thought, Jesus Christ, can I turn to them and say, excuse me, but will you metaphorically shut up? Because you're really distracting the audience. But maybe I can't do that because they're deaf and they're not actually making any noise. So I just had to butt up with them.
In these PC times, Toby. Don't step.
I thought maybe it was a brilliant new kind of disruptive technique employed by the Underground Literary Alliance to kind of screw up people's readings.
Or undermine Toby Young, the I Hate Toby Young fan club. Mr. Carter, I don't know, was he...
They could have been Greg and Carter's children who he'd specially trained to perform this task, but I doubt he's probably that concerned.
Well, one never knows. And speaking of Mr. Carter, your first book, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People...
Did succeed in alienating him.
It did. It really did. He of all people who started out in lampooning everything, I was really fascinated by this whole turn of events with him, as I'm sure you were.
Well, I have a theory as to why it is that journalists who themselves are the best hitmen, great at coming after people, have essentially built their reputation on taking down kind of members of the establishment, why they in particular... I mean, Harold Evans is another great example.
Right.
Are so thin-skinned and kind of use the full kind of apparatus of the law to try and retaliate whenever anyone tries to do that to them. Michael Moore's another good example. If you try and go after Michael Moore, he will immediately kind of slap a gagging order on you and use kind of various firms of attorneys to tie you up in knots. He knows how to do it because, of course, it's been done to him.
Right.
And the reason I think these people, these great rebels, these iconoclasts, are themselves so thin-skinned is because they recognize that there's a kind of homicidal impulse, this kind of Oedipal rage that fuels their own motives, their own takedowns. And when that's turned on themselves, they get terrified because they recognize the demon within themselves.
It's
and they
the rat,
see it in somebody
trapped,
else.
Rat trapped in the proverbial corner.
That's right.
They have to lash out. Yeah.
And Graydon actually emerges in a reasonably good way.
He does,
from my
indeed.
Book. I mean,
yeah.
I certainly wasn't, it wasn't, you know, just critical of him. I thought it was a fairly, you know, fair-minded and rounded portrait. And he initially seemed to take it on the chin. I remember when he was asked about it by Women's Wear Daily, he said, every day when I came into work, I used to make a list of things to do, and at the bottom of that list, I always wrote, fire Toby. But because I never got to the bottom of the list, he somehow managed to survive at the magazine for 2 years. I mean, you know, not an entirely, not a straightforward endorsement of my professional competence, but nevertheless, a fairly good-humored attack. Now, that's most recently he was asked who he'd like to play him if my book's ever made into a film, and he said, I don't know about me, but for Toby Young, Vern Troyer, who is the dwarf who plays Mini-Me in the Austin Powers films.
For those of the audience members who are listening to this podcast, why don't you bring them up to speed how you actually infiltrated Vanity Fair. That's when I met you when you first came over. I was at Cream Magazine, and we had some great times.
Yeah.
We were hitting the social scene.
You were always spiking my drinks with some kind of foul chemical substance.
No, but bring people up to speed, your rise as a journalist in the UK, and why you actually hit their radar screen to begin with.
Well, I started a magazine in 1991 called The Modern Review, which was an iconoclastic literary magazine. We used to run kind of long scholarly pieces about people like Madonna and Arnold Schwarzenegger by these academics, you know, and they weren't altogether complimentary, but they weren't, you know, necessarily critical either. We used to call it low culture for highbrows, or smart writers on dumb stuff. And it attracted the attention of Graydon, and we met a couple of times when he was over in London in the mid-90s. And then when the magazine... I then got into this terrific fight with the woman I'd co-founded the magazine with, Julie Burchill.
Right, of course.
She left her husband and ran off with a woman who worked for the magazine and became a lesbian, and then wanted to make this...
No, she didn't. She was a lesbian before this.
No, she was really...
She was straight before that?
She was straight, as far as anyone knew.
Huh. But I always thought you were born that persuasion.
Well, I think at the risk of alienating lesbians, I think that's probably more true of homosexual men than it is of homosexual women. Homosexuality in women, in my experience, is more capricious. And they can often change their minds. One minute they're a lesbian, the next they're straight. That's why lesbian relationships tend to founder after about 2 weeks. This is all very controversial. I'm sure there are very happily married, quote-unquote, women out there to other women. Anyway, Julie Burchill, as far as I knew, had not hitherto had any lesbian experiences. Suddenly, she leaves her husband. Well, actually, for a while, she was with her husband and also with this girl. And I remember saying to her husband, Cosmo, you know...
This must be a fantastic arrangement.
Well, I said, aren't you nervous that, you know, that she may leave you for this woman? I mean, aren't you nervous that she may be rejecting the entire male gender? And he said, what, are you kidding? I love that dyke action. And the poor deluded fool, a couple of weeks later, she was gone.
So that was my...
Anyway, so the magazine...
Well, you got a lot of there was a lot of press around that, a lot of scandal, obviously. Your name was elevated.
Julie wanted to make her girlfriend, who was about 12, the editor of the magazine. And she wanted to turn it into this kind of lesbian, feminist, radical, separatist publication. And I thought, you know, screw that. So I assembled the kind of two or three members of staff out of the hundreds who were still loyal to me. And everyone else wanted to turn it over to this 12-year-old. And we closed down the magazine in secret. We produced a final issue, took it down to the printers. You know, almost a military operation trying to keep this secret from everyone else in the magazine who was in the Julie camp. And we managed to produce it and distribute it. So suddenly the first Julie knows that I've closed down the magazine. She gets a magazine on her doorstep saying, this is the final issue of the Modern Review. And and I broke the story that she'd become a lesbian and had run off and, you know, was trying to take it out from under me. And it did. It got more column inches than Bosnia. It was the biggest news story of the week, I think, in the week the story broke. Julie compared me to Hitler in the national press.
Why is, you know, that was one of my questions. Why are we so enamored by scandals as a society? What is it? I mean, you look how many newspapers England has and how many of these tabloid weeklies we have in America, and it's made Murdoch a multi-billionaire.
Yeah. Scandal sells. I think people want to discover that celebrities have feet of clay. You know, it's the build them up and knock them down syndrome.
Right.
It's the mob. The mob wants to know that ultimately they're in charge. And the only reason these kind of celebrities who've been lording it over them, who've been living life high on the hog in their private jets and in St. Bart's and on their yachts, they want to know that at any time, if they put a foot wrong, if they break the contract, that they can be taken down.
Right.
It's essentially the mob reasserting its power, reminding celebrities that they're only there by their leave.
Except for sports figures, they seem to have the Teflon skin. They seem to be able to fall out of favor, and then as long as they've helped win the Premier Cup or, you know, the NBA title, all is forgiven.
Yeah, I think jocks get an easier ride than say movie stars. And there's obviously a clear PR strategy for dealing with a kind of potentially career-wrecking scandal, which is just to pretend it isn't happening.
Right.
You know, just to sort of shamelessly kind of let it wash over you. The moment you appear to be guilty or ashamed, that's it. You're finished.
Now, see, Clinton should have just said, yes, I had an indiscretion. It's none of your business. And we would have saved billions of dollars.
Yeah, no, it's always... It's
and that soiled dress over there, hey, you know, what can I tell you about that?
It's never the scandal. It's always the cover-up they get you on here.
Yeah, exactly. So that led Graydon Carter then, that blip on the radar, which was a large blip, let's face it. It cost him to take notice of you and your journalistic prowess.
He called me up and in 95 and... you know, he said, how'd you like to come over here and work for me for a month? You know, see how you like it over here. I said, sure. You know, I was virtually on the next plane. And, you know, 2.5 years later, I was still there. God knows how I managed to survive 2.5 years.
They were mad times.
I think Graydon regarded me as his court jester. I mean, I'll give you an example. Shortly after I arrived, I discovered that my office mate, a guy called Chris, I discovered it was his birthday. And I thought, you know, on Fleet Street, when you discover that it's one of your colleagues' birthdays, typically you hire a strippogram to come into the office and do a little dance for them. So I thought...
Have a laugh.
So I thought, I'll hire a strippogram to surprise Chris on his birthday. I managed to persuade the editor of the fashion director of the magazine to let me use the fashion department for this kind of entertainment. The stripper Julie arrived at the appointed hour. She was, you know, straight from central casting, head to toe stonewashed denim, whipped that off, head to toe leopard skin underwear. She had a beatbox which she had brought along, and she was playing. The song she played was Michael Jackson's Beat It. So, you know, I'm there in the fashion department with my friend Chris, a couple of kind of staffers on the magazine, guys. This stripper starts strutting her stuff to Beat It when there's a knock at the door. And I kill the music, tell everyone to be quiet, crack open the door, and it's Bronwyn Carter, Graydon Carter's then 4-year-old daughter. Can I see the fashion department? I look around and there's this naked girl standing a few feet behind me. I'm like, not right now, honey. Can you come back in 5 minutes? And there's a pause. Everyone held their breath. Okay. She went away, closed the door. Music comes back on. Stripper starts strutting her stuff again. You know, breasts in face, the whole nine yards. 5 minutes later, there's another knock on the door. This time it's three little girls. And it turned out that in my wisdom, I had arranged for a strippogram to come into the office on Take Our Daughters to Work Day. And there was literally this army of little girls waiting patiently outside the... There was only one exit.
Right.
And with their kind of matronly mothers. And you know, I managed to sneak this... We sort of put a big fur coat on her from the fashion closet and pretended she was, you know, one of Anna Wintour's colleagues, and managed to sneak her out. But, you know, vanity fair being what it is, within 24 hours, I was known as that English chump who hired a strippogram on Take Our Daughters to Work Day. And I think Graydon... I sort of expected him to fire me, but I think it was so off the charts in terms of inappropriate behavior that it was actually it drifted over into the realm of comedy.
But is it inappropriate? It was just serendipitous that it happened to fall on that day.
Yeah, I think after that, many of the women who worked at the magazine thought I'd done it on purpose.
Oh, of course, you know. And again, you know, at what point did we jump the shark with this PC attitude? What year was that? Where everyone became so concerned about you're doing the right thing, saying the right thing.
I think it was.
Can't ruffle any feathers, for God's sake.
I think it started in the late 80s. I think, you know, historians trace it back to the Antioch rules, the draconian rules at Antioch College about regarding dating. You know, you were said to remain 3 inches apart. You were said to ask permission if you wanted to put your hand on their leg and so on and so forth.
Right.
You know, if I'd ever asked a girl permission, I never would have, you know, I'd still be a virgin. I remember trying to pass off my strippogram activity to Graydon by claiming it was ironic sexism. I was just quoting sexist behavior. I wasn't actually engaging in it. And he gave me a puzzled look and he said, ironic sexism? That's like ironic anti-Semitism. It doesn't go over in this town, okay?
Again, with Graydon's background, it's just he got the gig because of his background. Let's face it.
Well, it looks as though the book may now be made into a film. And I think Graydon may well re-embrace both me and the book when the film is made. Because I have to say, for artistic reasons, the guy who's adapted the book for the screen has turned Graydon into quite a sympathetic character, a bit like the Meryl Streep character in The Devil Wears Prada.
I was going to say that must have helped you tremendously with the success of that movie and pushing your project along.
I think it has helped. Though in a way, it's a double-edged sword. In some respects, we can say, hey, look, you know, this movie made $100 million and
it's setting you up for failure, huh?
Well, you can say, you know, but on the other hand, it looks like kind of we're there with the second Volcano movie, you know,
yes.
Which is a
year
later.
And you guys were there first anyway.
It looks as though it'll be made, and they're talking about casting either Jeff Bridges, Bill Murray, or wait for it, George Clooney as Graydon.
Well, of course, we know which one Graydon would like.
If I'm played by Vern Troyer in the film and Graydon's played by George Clooney, I think he might like it.
I think maybe he'd be better served by Randy Quaid.
I wanted Larry Shandling.
Gary Shandling. Gary Shandling, I like that.
He's got that right combination of kind of galloping egotism and fantastic insecurity.
Or Fred Willard.
Yes, he'd be very good too.
Fred may be like a year or two older than Graydon, although I'm not certain. Well, that's and who will be playing you? Do we know?
We've got
I know what your wish list is.
We've got an offer out to Brad Pitt, but so far he hasn't come back to us. Philip Seymour Hoffman would be great,
How about Paul Giamatti?
Yeah, I think he'd be good too. Yeah. He'd be great.
Yeah,
I mean, he's.
I can see he's got that self-deprecating edge that you have.
He's quite good at playing kind of the not so lovable loser, the dislikable rogue.
Let's talk about this book and why you had to eliminate the name of the central character and the Mr. Big. Was there really that much concern that the powers that be might be unleashed on Mr. Young and you'd ruin your family and your future generations forever and ever?
This guy, who is one of the two or three most powerful producers in Hollywood, he called me in 2002, having just read my book. He was in the south of France for a month, and he'd found it under a throw cushion on a billionaire's yacht.
No, I thought that was a bunch of...
No, that's true.
That is true.
He called me out of the blue.
So one of his little chippies may have had it on board one weekend.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe one of the crew was reading it. I don't know. but anyway, he had read the book. He called me as I was on my way to a wedding in Norfolk, and he identified himself. And I'm like, yeah, right. That's you, isn't it, Sean? That's you. My friend Sean was always crank calling me.
Right.
I'm like, you're going to have to sound a lot more elevated than that if you're going to have to try and pass yourself off as this guy. You sound like you work in some burger joint in New Jersey. He's like, no, it's really me. anyway, when I got over that hump, he said he'd read my book, and he had a picture he wanted me to write. You know, I'm like, this is a crank call, isn't it? But it really was him. And but he said as a condition of meeting with me, I had to give him a solemn promise that I would never write about him. I would never write about any of our meetings. I wouldn't use any of the material I accumulated as a result of writing this picture for him. And, of course, I instantly gave him my word.
Yes, and you're immediately writing your book with all of those facts.
Whipped out the notepad at that very moment.
Yeah.
I didn't at that stage intend to write the book. I thought, you know, great, I'm going to become this hugely successful Hollywood screenwriter. No more memoirs for me.
Exactly.
You know, it was only when it all went pear-shaped that I had to fall back on the how I failed in X formula. Anyway, my way of kind of rationalizing writing about both him and the meetings we had and so forth in the book was to say, well, if I don't identify him and don't say anything about him, which makes him identifiable, then in some roundabout, slightly sleazy way, I will be keeping my promise.
and, of course, you get everyone trying to guess who that inside, you know.
Well, actually, no one's done that so far. I hoped that, you know,
I would imagine page six or somewhere.
Yeah.
Somewhere down the road we're going
to
find.
Do live in mortal fear that someone will say exactly who it is.
Yeah.
And at which point it'll come to his attention, and then he'll read the book, and then the lawsuits will start
flying. Oh, he must know already. Come on.
I don't know.
You don't think so? Well, after this podcast, you will, because I can. I initially thought it was Mr. Weinstein. When I read the intro, I just thought it has to be him. Because he was lampooned in Entourage last year.
I can neither affirm nor deny. I plead the fifth.
Anyway, the sound of no hands clapping. It really is. I haven't read the whole thing, but it just looks like it's another outrageous addition to your ongoing memoir.
Yeah, well, there's a little bit of Graydon material in there. When As well as, you know, there's a lot of dish about people in Hollywood and people in
the
media.
The Liz Hurley story I love, too. That's another one you should share with our audience.
I was just going to...
But let's go on the Graydon.
let's stick to Graydon.
We love...
I'm obsessed. I'm a stalker. We can get on to Elizabeth Hurley if you want. Skip Graydon.
No, let's do Graydon. Let's do some more on Graydon. Okay. Graydon, I hope you're enjoying this.
when I'd written the first book, but before it had come out, he emailed me and asked me if he could see a copy. And I thought, oof, you know, I'm not sure if I want to open that can of worms. Yeah. But then I thought, well, he's so connected in the publishing world. He can, and with the galleys were out there at that stage anyway, right. He can easily get hold of a copy, so I might as well just send him one.
Right.
So I sent him one, and a couple of weeks later I got an email back. Is it too late to make any corrections? I thought, oh, no. You know, well, you know, and I thought, you know, in the book I kind of make the argument that he, since editing Spy, he's crossed over to the dark side, and I thought he's gonna make a case for the defense.
Now let's just clarify, because there's some listeners who don't remember Spy magazine, and this is what I keep alluding to. Spy was a great it was what, Punch for the U.S. or more of a Harvard Lampoon for a hip edgy audience.
H.L. Mencken's Mercury for the 1980s.
There you go. Very very well put.
It was a great, irreverent, iconoclastic, satirical,
lampooned everything
magazine,
and anything.
Took down everybody.
Yeah,
fearlessly.
And that's why I find it so odd that Graydon would you know, find anything troubling in your book.
Yeah, well,
having that background, but I guess he lost his sense of humor working for the monolith that he works for.
Well, he I think so, because when I asked him what he'd like to correct in the book, I got this email back, and it consisted of something like 24 corrections. And the first one, and they were all along these lines, was...
24 listed.
Yeah, it was, on page 84, you say that Anna Wintour's office is the largest office in the building. I think you'll find my office is the largest office in the building. If you get that kind of thing wrong, people just won't take you seriously.
Oh, my God. You've got to be kidding me. Get the tape measures out, boys. Get the fact checkers and their tape measures.
I think he actually did have his architect. There was a story that... When he had his office... He went to Human Resources after Vanity Fair, after he sort of found his feet on Vanity Fair,
right,
and asked for a larger office. And they explained that the only way they could do this would be if they actually allocated more square footage to Vanity Fair, and that would put the cat amongst the pigeons as far as the other magazines,
ooh,
were concerned in the building.
Right.
And the person he had asked said, as if kind of, you know, dismissing the argument, listen, Graydon, the only way we could possibly do this is if we redesigned the existing office space allocated to Vanity Fair, made your office larger and everyone else's smaller. I said, okay, let's do that. And the rumor was that he actually sneaked his architect into the building, had him go to Anna Wintour's office with one of those things, you know, those wheelie things,
yeah,
actually measured the square footage and made sure that his office was exactly 2 square foot bigger than hers.
This is also the same man who bragged in his editorial page when we had the smoking ban that he was still smoking in his office.
Yeah.
Did you read that?
No. Anyway, Liz Hurley?
Liz Hurley. I love this story. I must say, I never met Liz in person. I saw her on the block a couple of times. She stays with a fashion designer that lives around the corner from me. Very pretty woman in person.
I'm sure, yeah.
Well, you would know more than I would about this. Pray tell.
This story appears in the book because at one stage, a mini Hollywood studio was interested in purchasing the rights to my first book outright. And they managed to attach Julia Roberts to play my wife.
Bravo.
And they wanted to see if they could get Hugh Grant to play me, to try and recreate that Notting Hill chemistry. And I thought, when they said that...
Sorry,
thought,
Toby, that's a stretch. Sorry, I like you.
Yeah, he's way too old.
He's far too serious.
Well, I thought, when I heard this, I thought, well, that's it, the deal's going south. Because...
Right.
Back in 94, I had a big falling out with Liz Hurley. I persuaded her to read an audiobook version of this fucking and shopping novel called Ambition, which had been written by Julie Burchill, who was then hadn't fallen out with. We were going to give it away as a cover mount with the magazine I was then editing,
right,
as a way of, you know, boosting sales. And so she read the book. And did it very well. And then I asked her for some photographs to illustrate, you know, to put on the front and back of the cassette. She put me in touch with this photographer called Patrick Stoddart, who'd taken a fairly saucy set of pictures of her in the Dorchester Hotel in London. And
what the young women will do to rise to the top.
Well, you know, in those days, she was prepared to do a great deal. And pictures from this set had appeared in Loaded, GQ, Esquire. And in one of them, she's kind of topless, and she's got a kind of basque. She's got a kind of suspender belt, these black knickers, and this was in the kind of pre-Brazilian era.
Right.
You can see these kind of great tufts of pubic hair kind of sprouting out on either side. Quite erotic if you're into that kind of thing. Anyway.
the German swim team. Oops, sorry.
Anyway, so I thought, great, we'll put that one on the front. And then there was another one of her completely topless, what we were going to put on the back. And the day after she read this cassette for us and put me in touch with the photographer, Hugh Grant took her to the world premiere of Four Weddings and a Funeral, in which she wore a dress designed by Versace, which was held together with safety pins. Suddenly she's on the front page of every paper in the world. She becomes the world's most famous kind of trophy girlfriend.
It's amazing.
And she gets offered all these modeling deals. Suddenly movie offers are coming in. She doesn't want these naked pictures of her appearing anymore.
No way,
which suddenly she wants to kind of, you know, put a lid on her sordid past. So she threatens me with a lawsuit if I go ahead and print these pictures. I've already printed the cassette covers at this point.
Right.
So then I get this kind of horribly threatening phone call from this kind of vicious lawyer. And in the end, we have to pulp the cassette covers and reprint it again with a kind of censored on it. But I then took this story to the press and I said, you know, fame has turned her head. She's turned on one of her oldest friends. And my line was that, you know, at that point, Elizabeth had been in a number of very kind of low-rent British B-movies in which she'd played kind of sexy sirens. And I say, you know, Elizabeth has taken her clothes off in virtually every movie she's ever been in. You know, she must be the first actress in history who hasn't actually got noticed until she put her clothes on.
Oh, geez.
You know, generally went to town with this. It got a lot of tabloid coverage, and she absolutely hates me now. And, of course, the moment this mini studio asked Hugh Grant if he was interested...
She's just walked into the Soho House.
Liz, hi.
Hey, Liz, how are you? you must get me the cassette so we can drop some excerpts into this podcast.
Oh, yeah, I won't be till I'm back in London, but I'll happily send it to you.
That'd be fantastic.
I can't send you the photographs, unfortunately. As a condition of settling the lawsuit, I had to hand them back in a plain brown envelope to...
Really? Now, how did you meet her originally? How did you become friends?
I met her through William Cash, a journalist friend of mine who was then based in L.A. He was great friends with her. He still is great friends with her. In fact, he got married a couple of years ago, and I was invited to the wedding. But as soon as Liz heard that I was going to be there, she said, unless you disinvite Toby Young, I'm not coming.
Please. Are you serious?
And I thought, well, you know, Liz, that might work with somebody of lesser moral fiber than my good and old friend William. But you've got another thing coming if you think he's going to strike me off the guest list to accommodate some Hollywood diva. Within seconds, I've been disinvited from that wedding.
Really?
Yeah.
And how did he disinvite you? By phone, call, or
email? He just called me
up
and said, it's your Elizabeth and I'm choosing her.
Come on.
He did.
Shame on him. Talk about un-PC.
Yeah. Right. I think he already at that point sold the pictures of his wedding to Hello magazine.
Oh, God.
It was all conditional upon Elizabeth turning up.
Oh, my God. Is there no justice for Mr. Young? Who's your biggest influence as a journalist or as a writer?
I'm a big fan of Tom Wolfe. His essay, Radical Chic, for me, is one of the high points of 20th century journalism. Not only is it incredibly well reported, but it's his fearlessness which really stands out. I mean, he went into the absolute heart of the kind of radical establishment. It takes place, the whole scene, as I'm sure you know, it's set at the Bernstein's house,
right.
And they're having a fundraiser for the Black Panthers. And, you know, it was the dawn of the kind of PC era. And he just went in there. He whipped out his notepad. He noted every single embarrassing detail, like the fact that they'd given all their usual kind of African American staff the day off, so the Panthers wouldn't be embarrassed.
Right,
and try to hire white help, and you know all kinds of funny details like this, which are in the piece. And then he just stood there with his notepad in his hand, and then published this devastating piece. Devastating.
What's the biggest misconception about Toby Young?
Well, I think people who've read my books expect me to be this kind of hell-raising, kind of ne'er-do-well, self-sabotaging kind of lunatic. And when they meet me, they're invariably disappointed because, you know, I don't get arrested or I don't pass out or I don't vomit on somebody. I guess, you know, I have now kind of sobered up a little. I'm married.
I have two young children. Yeah.
It's absolutely the equivalent of a 12-step program, and I really don't need to go on a 12-step program because I have a 1-year-old and a 2-year-old. And
sleep deprivation's murderous, yeah, isn't
if
it?
If you know that you know, at 5:30 a.m. come hell or high water, a little face is going to be in yours saying, "Let's play hide and seek." You're not going to go out drinking till 4 a.m.
Exactly.
Daddy, I'm hungry. Let's go to the zoo.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. No, it can sober you up very, very quickly, as it did. And it's also, that was a difficult reality check for you, wasn't it, in some ways?
Having children?
Yeah, the separation of church and state when you have a career and you're trying to establish yourself, get to the next level.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly you have to prioritize.
Yeah.
That can be very sobering.
Absolutely. I mean, your social life really is the first thing to go. One of the
and all your old friends, all your old pals.
Gone. Our only friends now are kind of our next door neighbors who have children in the same age as ours. You know, it doesn't matter if they work as shelf stackers in, you know, Walmart. We have more in common with them than we do with you know, our oldest friends. One of the, not that there's anything wrong with stacking shelves in Walmart.
I was going to say, is that PC? Well, you can be as un-PC as you want, Toby. I don't care.
One of the themes of the book is about the conflict between career and family. And I make the argument that men today, because they're expected to do so much around the home and play such an important part in rearing their children, have to make the same kind of choice that women had to make 25 years ago, between really throwing themselves into their careers or living up to their responsibilities as spouses and parents. But actually, it's kind of a false dichotomy. The journey I make in the book is from thinking that, you know, my wife and children are holding me back, and if it wasn't for kind of having to spend all this time going to the zoo and playing hide and seek, I would have this thriving career in Hollywood.
Right.
Actually, it dawns on me at the end of the book that without the kind of order and stability that my wife and family provide, you know, I'd be a semi-itinerant alcoholic. It wasn't like I was achieving anything before I got married. It's only because I've got Caroline in my life, really, that I've been able to write anything.
And I've read that you need that break from the day-to-day grind, the family time, the Saturdays and the Sundays, whatever it may entail, where you really would like to be spending it writing, perhaps, or you know, going to the posh parties.
Right. No, you have to spend it going to the kids' parties.
Right.
I mean, you've probably experienced something similar in your own life. I mean, you were a bit of a hellraiser when I first met you. You didn't have any kids at that stage.
No strings attached, right? I was a serial monogamist.
Have you found it a difficult adjustment to make, or are you...
Of course, I am right in there with you. I find that was the most difficult transition in my life, because I got married later in life, in my late 30s. And it was, and my wife is still harping about prioritizing weekend time.
Right.
Don't get, you know, and now with this new venture, which can be 16 hours a day if I really wanted to, you know, bear down.
That is the biggest flashpoint of my marriage. It's my wife wanted me to spend less time working and more time with her and the children.
But then you know, we grew up a generation where we never saw our fathers.
Mm-hmm.
They were always working. Yeah. That was always, you know, you maybe saw them, glimpses of them in the morning if you got up early enough. And certainly not at night, because you were always asleep before they got home.
But I think it ill behooves men of our generation to complain too much about what a better deal our dads had compared to us. You know, they didn't have to spend time, you know, taking the kids out and so forth. But
changing
the washing up,
and all
changing
that.
Diapers. Yeah. But actually, I think it's a bit like a white farmer in South Africa complaining that, you know, they had it better under apartheid. Well, yeah. Maybe they did, but that doesn't mean it was a just system.
Right.
And maybe it's right that we should share some of the drudgery.
Right. No, but I think it's, you know, it's the adjustment you make. And, I've got friends, I'm sure you've got friends that check out from that situation. They can't deal with it. They can't cope.
Yeah. Yeah, and their marriage's like, founder.
And they just go, "I'm out of here." I didn't realize the commitment.
I'm talking as though, you know, spending time with my wife and kids is the most appalling chore. Whereas, in fact,
where are they right now, Toby?
They're in London, but my wife's coming out tomorrow. Yeah. But actually, you know, I do really enjoy it. And I'm not just saying that in case she listens to this. For me, as for you, I think if you leave it quite late. I mean, I didn't get married till my late 30s either. You've so exhausted all the possibilities of going out, of trying to pick up chicks, of going to each new club as it opens, of, you know, getting high and staying high for 48 hours, whatever it might be. You've done it so often for so long that actually, you know, living a much more sober existence, having a family, having kids to kind of keep you on the straight and narrow, it's a wonderfully refreshing change.
But the Viking gene is always there, ready to rear its ugly head.
You feel like one of those superheroes in The Incredibles. You know, the old superhero costume is still gathering dust in the closet.
You hear the Viking chanting on the weekend, you know, and, you know, maybe it's one little thing that can set you off. And I do cherish those weekends when I'm alone. You will cherish them as your kids get older.
Right.
Who's the biggest media whore in the English-speaking world? Or is that a continual, fresh crop every day?
That's a hotly contested title.
Yeah.
By media whore, do you mean a sort of publicity slut?
Yes, exactly.
Well, I'm tempted to say Paris Hilton. But maybe that's a little too obvious.
Yeah, I think she's very obvious.
Clinton seems to like the sound of his own voice.
Come on, Bill. Bill is a champion of the free world, man.
Are you a Clinton fan?
I am. I am a Clinton fan.
I was pleased that he popped up at the final of the World Cup. I'm less offended by publicity whores than by prominent and successful people who like to pretend that none of that means anything to them. I remember asking the Vanity Fair photo editor who the biggest prima donna was they had ever had to photograph for the cover.
Right.
And without pausing for breath, she said Emma Thompson, which was a bit of a surprise. I was expecting to be J-Lo or Demi Moore.
Yeah.
No, it was
really?
the English woman who pretends that, you know, she's above all that kind of thing. That
right.
means nothing to
right.
her. I remember there was a great episode of Inside the Actor's Studio, one of my favorite shows, because it's not at all obsequious or sycophantic. I actually wrote a spoof of that in which Ron Jeremy is the guest, and James Lappin is like, "Ron, tell us about the breakthrough you made in Suck My Cock 3. You know? But Spielberg was on the show, and he was on stage being interviewed in the kind of chair.
Right.
And he said, you know, midway through, he said, "I don't like the implication that I'm on a higher level than the audience. I'm going to bring my chair down to that level." And he sort of made this point of bringing his chair down and putting it in front of the stage so he would be on the same level as the people. They all kind of applauded wildly. This kind of great egalitarian.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, I'm sure he left.
One with the people.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah.
Come to my next movie.
Yeah, it was this kind of pretense that you're a great egalitarian democratic soul. I find that really rubs me up the wrong way.
You know, I have to ask you this. Have you ever been offended by anything that's been written about you?
God, I'm offended by actually everything that's written about me.
No, I mean, seriously. is it just...
I'm hiring a lawyer right now.
I mean, is it just more and more amusing by you see people attack you?
I tell you, as I get older, actually, I become more and more thin-skinned. I can easily
see
myself...
Are you serious?
Yeah. You'd think you'd get tougher, but... one thing that irritates me is that I constantly tell these stories at my own expense. When people write about me, review my books or my plays or whatever it might be, they'll then repeat these stories but give the impression that they have dug them up through their own diligent research and they are exposing me by producing this kind of wonderfully kind of compromising nugget. When in fact, they've just got it from reading something I've written.
Right.
That kind of cheeses me off. But
that's plagiarism.
I think Kingsley Amis said that... you know, a bad review can ruin your breakfast, but you shouldn't let it ruin your lunch. And that's the right attitude.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's very good. That's very good. You know, I look at your career, and it's like a Woody Allen character. You know, the perennial hypochondriac, woe is me, downtrodden loser, you know, trying to get it, trying to gain some footing, never getting to the next level. How do you deal?
Well, I seem to have carved out this niche for myself as a professional failure. And the difficulty in occupying this niche is that as soon as I begin to enjoy any sort of success, my career is going to go down the pan. I have to somehow continue to fail, and in the most abject and humiliating way, if I'm going to be able to, you know, pay the mortgage. Yeah, the only way I can afford to make those payments is if I remain unemployed. And it's a slightly topsy-turvy, bizarro position to be in. And I'm hoping, obviously, that this book sells no copies. My wife leaves me. I get cancer. And then, of course, I'll have enough material for yet another self-deprecating
for the last, for the final
part in the trilogy.
Right, yeah. And you won't have to live to the ripe age of 60 or something and have all these other volumes.
Yeah.
Well, it's a tough job, Toby, and I think you do it honorably. You do it with intelligence, wit, and hopefully honesty. There's truth in advertising, I think, in your book.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Continued success. Thanks for being on the Culture Catch. We look forward to seeing you soon.
Great fun. Thank you.
I don't care for China. Japan's far too small. I've rumbled the Rio Grande. I hate Asia Minor. I can't bear Bengal. And I shudder to think of the awful stink on the road to Samarkand. It's frankly hell, that filthy smell on the road to Samarkand. But I like America. I have played around every slappy, happy hunting ground, and I find America okay. I've been about a bit, but I must admit that I didn't know half of it till I hit the USA. No likely lass in Boston, Mass, from fashion will recoil. In Dallas, Texas, they talk of sex, but only think of oil. New Jersey dames go up in flames if someone mentions bed. In Chicago, Illinois, any girl who meets a boy giggles and shoots him dead. But I like America. Its society offers infinite variety and comfort. I shall return someday to the good old USA. I've loathed every acre from Cannes to Canton. I also deplore Bombay. I've jeered at Jamaica and seen through Ceylon and exploded the myth of those flying fifth on the road to Mandalay. I'll never miss those blasted fifths on the road to Mandalay. But I like America. I have traveled far from Northumberland to Zanzibar, but I find America okay. I've roamed the Spanish Main, eaten sugar cane, but I never tasted cellophane till I struck the USA. Delegates from southern states are nervy and distraught. In New Orleans, the wrought iron screens are dreadfully overwrought. Beneath each tree in Tennessee, erotic books are read. And when alligators thud through the Mississippi mud, sex rears its ugly head. But I like America, its simplicity, and its passion for publicity and comfort, man. Give me a holiday in the good old USA.
I'd like to thank today's sponsors, WebHSP. For all of your web hosting needs, it's WebHSP.com. And our friends at Final Draft. If you're writing a script and you need help, there's no easier software than Final Draft. Check them out at FinalDraft.com. This is Dusty Wright for The Culture Catch. We'll see you soon. Converge is the word.